是吧？That was my attempt at a Tony Biggs mouth pop as he finishes the Telephone and Rubber Band Orchestra, or is it the Penguin and Rubber Band Orchestra remix of a whole lot of words like that that I get wrong every time I fill the show. It's Tony Wilson filling for Tony yes. Biggs, and filling with me is Tony Martin, two tones for a tone. We'll be doing the next 3 hours, as we did, I think, in around mid-January.
That's right.
For an absent Tony Biggs. And we'll be taking a bit of talk back. We'll be talking a few books. We'll be talking a few DVDs.
Nerdish topics will arise. Where is Tony Biggs?
Haven't been told.
Right.
It was one of those calls from Mick James where he operates a little bit like the Stasi. He lets you know what you need to know, which is, want to fill on Friday for Tony Biggs? I said I'd love to.
Last time we filled in, it was for Headley on the Party Show. Did we ever find out what he was up to?
No. No, we didn't.
I'd like to think he's maybe producing a sequel to Trojan Warrior. Would Triple R listeners be familiar with the Trojan Warrior?
Trojan Warrior was, I believe, I think even in an era where Australian films have generally been B-grade, he would even acknowledge that this was a B-grade attempt. You know, it started out not even aiming for A-grade, didn't it?
Was it straight to video? Dare we say that?
Yeah, I think that's right.
I think there might have been a screening somewhere, but it was Stan the Man Longanides and I think Chopper...
Jacko? No.
Yeah, Jacko. Chopper Reed was in it, playing a character called Eric Banner. Seriously. And that's Trojan Warrior, probably at your video shop, written and produced by our very own Headley Gritter here at Triple R.
And Yobbo Up the Guts, which you've been following over the last couple of years, appeared to be the logical successor to that film, just in concept and
has that ever
trajectory.
Emerged? Has that come out ever? That was
the one that was being at one point, wasn't it?
It was Warwick Kappa and Jacko and Bill Hunter.
But Bill Hunter, what we heard at some point was that Bill Hunter had taken over directorial responsibilities after the original director had left Yobbo's Up the Guts.
After being punched in the face by Warwick Kappa, or vice versa.
But Hunter was He I mean, he hasn't directed that many films.
He's directed
he?
Nothing. He's never directed anything. He's directed somebody in the correct way to pour a jug of beer at the Rising Sun. I've seen him do that on several occasions. But no credits and whatsoever. And what do you know? The film has never ever been released. And it was there was a press release went out that it was going to come out on DVD. Yobbo's up the guts.
I'm not sure it is coming out.
No,
I think it probably doesn't have the amount. I don't think it has the excess of the 90 minutes in order to cut down to the 90 minutes. So it won't have that important stage of filmmaking known as editing.
We're already on to films. We were meant to keep it fairly topical this morning, weren't we?
Yeah, we can do, over the course of the morning, we will be guided by the listener as well. We could do news. There's a few news stories going along around. Sol Trujillo is in the papers today.
What's he done?
Saying what a good job he did at this Telstra. mainly he talked about how much more, how the revenue streams and market shares and everything. It was all stuff like that. No, he didn't deal with questions like ever having to deal with Telstra and whether, you know, there's, I don't know if you find calling Telstra a pleasurable experience.
No, it's never a pleasurable experience.
Anyway, he's got an opinion piece in The Age. You might want to talk about the new boss of Telstra. He's been named.
Can I ask, Sol Trujillo, is that how you say it?
Yeah.
He's not the same Trujillo who ruled the Dominican Republic with an iron fist for 50 or 60 years. El Jefe, it's not him, is it? He didn't move on from the Dominican Republic to Telstra.
I think he's a...
There's not many Trujillos, you see, I'm just wondering.
Petty despots who move into telecommunications. Communications are a small club of which, if it is the same Trujillo, he is the probably the sole member.
Yeah, I think Pablo Duvalier ran Optus for a few years as well, so
really?
He could be onto something there.
Yeah, well, certainly telecommunications and broadband rollout. I actually read an article last night. I think I didn't spot that Tom Wolfe is a raving right winger. Is that right?
Tom Wolfe, the writer.
Yeah.
Is he? I'm not sure.
He's quite. It was a very interesting article, but he seems very interested in this. You know how eugenics just immediately is a dirty, dirty word because it refers. You think back to.
I don't know what eugenics is.
Eugenics is the kind of idea that you can breed a master race. You know,
oh, right.
That there are characteristics of the human beings that are born. So therefore, you could never be, that person over there can never be smart.
Right, right.
Forget about their background. Forget about their race. Forget about, that person over there is born into their destiny. And so if you're playing with genes to create that kind of master race, you're probably beginning to work out
and
why this particular word has the negative connotation.
So Tom Wolfe would like to see a master race of people in three-piece white suits looking like riverboat gamblers.
No, it's not. It's much more interesting than that. He's interested in a guy called Harold O. Wilson, who's
right.
into this thing called sociobiology, which is that we really are, the Darwinism's logical extreme is that we really are imprinted at birth.
Right.
So, and he says that is the revolution to come. We had the technological revolution, and that's why I thought of it when you're talking about Trujillo and telecommunications, that the revolution to come is the neuroscience revolution.
And what will this
involve?
When
we all know at the moment, because they're picturing our brains now, they hook us up to cords, and they can look to see what part of the brain we're thinking with when things come up. They're going to work out what every part of the brain controls, and they're going to somehow work out what gene relates to what brain control. And the extremists in this front say that I was born to have this conversation with you. My entire life is preordained right down to this very conversation. That's the extreme position that Tom Wolfe was talking about. He doesn't believe it, but he's very interested in this guy called Harold O. Wilson.
And what can we do with this information? Will it result in weeding out the stupider people?
Oh, absolutely.
Is that the
idea? As soon as you can say you're a criminal, because have a look, that little bit of your brain just flashed up when we made you look at that red card. You are going to get a literal red card here, son, because you that is a criminal part of the brain. Came up on the test at 4, and you're gone. Sorry.
You're watching so you think you can dance.
Yeah.
Red card out of the pool.
Absolutely.
Well, out of the race.
They'll know that you'll want to watch so you think you can dance. He doesn't think you're socialized into liking that show. He says those people are born to like that show.
Really?
And you are born to like the Larry Sanders Show.
Well, okay. But see, the thing is, once you start talking about this kind of stuff, people eventually will start accuse you of being a Nazi. Because my father-in-law is big in the world of breeding out genetic disorders in dogs.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people...
Nazi.
You know...
Sounds already...
Exactly.
Sounds like
so he's Nazi. Already Nazi. He cops Nazi all the time. And all he's trying to do is because people breed dogs in their backyards and genetic errors multiply and then you're having to put the dog down at 7 because it can't walk properly.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is a way of genetically breeding out these disorders. But hello, Nazi. Suddenly Nazi.
Harold O. Wilson. He started in ants and no one minded.
No one minded ants. Yeah, get out of no magnifying minded. Glass.
And then he started in ants, won his PhD, he won his Nobel Prize with what he was saying of ants, because some ants are born to carry a little bit of sugar. they know from the start, they don't get taught to carry the sugar and to build the nest. They just
but they're working
know
as a,
from the start.
Aren't they working as a team? Isn't it just one big ant, really?
But why? How do you know which part in the team? How do you know you're a half forward flanker if you're an ant? You don't. No, there's no coach to tell you.
There's
this
no
is
draft
what, this
system.
This is what Harold O. Wilson says.
Right.
That there's no coach to tell you. You're just born hardwired into your brain. So your behaviour is determined by what's hardwired into your brain.
Is he leaving the O in his name just so that people won't confuse him with the former Prime Minister of England?
I think that's it.
Isn't that guy dead, though? I mean, that's a bit of vanity, isn't it, really?
That's right.
Harold O. Wilson. Goodness me.
I know.
Why don't you just throw one in? Tony O. Wilson.
Tony O. Tony C, I'd be. Campbell.
Right.
And there is, of course, I'm dealing with this, not a problem. I don't mind living in the vast and illustrious shadow of Tony Wilson Factory Records.
Well, I'm living in the vast shadow of Tony Martin, the crooner married to Sid Charisse for 100 years.
Really?
Yeah. Or no, actually, when you type in Tony Martin generally in Google, you get a guy in England who became a sort of a brand name for being allowed to kill people who break into your house.
Really?
There's a Tony Martin who, he was a farmer, and two people broke into his house. He shot them both dead and went to jail, and then the tabloids got behind and said, no, hang on, that was actually quite a good idea.
And can you take him? If you have a few successes, still get him in Google, or is he too far ahead?
The problem is he's become like, in England, his name is like Pauline Hanson's name. It's used as a...
This is a real Tony Martin situation.
Right. This is a Tony Martin scenario.
And you can't get him.
So, no, I can't take that guy. But Tony Wilson, I mean, he's going to surely Factory Records. He hasn't had any hits for a long time.
He's got a few behind him, though.
You can take that guy eventually.
Because he, of course, started the Hacienda nightclub, whereas I went to Goo nightclub at the Metro for much of the early 90s. It's sort of a different nightclub life.
The Metro in the early 90s, where, of course, final scene of Heaven Tonight with Guy Pearce was shot.
Well, there you go.
Sorry, I keep taking us from topical news stories back
to
movies.
I didn't really mean to bring up, because I think it might sound like, for people who just joined the chat, because I'm sounding so interested in what this sociobiologist Harold O. Wilson says about us being preordained to behave as we do, it might sound that I'm a bit of a eugenist, and I'll start getting a few emails saying, just Nazi but I'm really just reporting in on what Tom Wolfe himself is only reporting on. He's not saying I believe this totally. He's just saying I think this is the next revolution. Brain study.
Is Tom Wolfe doing a new book? I would ask,
because that Charlotte Simmons
thing. I didn't read that.
No one did.
I read.
No one. Everyone bought it, no one read it, because wasn't it all just an excuse for him to hang out in girls' dorms for a couple of years?
That seemed to be more compelling than the book itself. The image of Tom Wolfe in the full riverboat gambler three-piece white suit hanging out in basically Animal House with a notepad was a more poignant and compelling image than any that the book itself could have conjured. And I think that's the problem. I just went, you know, I just love thinking about Tom Wolfe, you know, going on a panty raid in the suit.
And his cover was meant to capture that. You were meant to want to buy the book. It kind of had a girl in kind of a Letterman jacket or something. It's meant to say cheerleader to you.
Yeah, right.
And Tom Wolfe hanging out with cheerleaders. And it was all a bit... I was happier
espousing eugenism.
Yeah, because when he was hanging out with astronauts and sound-breaking pilots, sound-barrier-breaking pilots...
And people taking a lot of LSD.
That's all fine.
Yeah, that's absolutely acceptable.
Said in the same article, when you mentioned LSD, he said he's against Ritalin, is it? The attention deficit disorder.
Right.
He did, in an article he wrote on LSD in the late 60s, he says Ritalin was one of the options, and that we're putting a whole lot of kids into drugged-out stupors.
Right. So a man in a three-piece white suit who wrote The Tangerine Flake Baby is telling us, hey, kids, maybe not so much with the drugs.
He did. He does. And he will.
Okay, we're going to get to actual hard news this morning.
We have hard news. You can talk about any news story you like. We will keep throwing up questions from the cultural world of books and film and DVDs, and you're welcome to talk about that. We've also got a guest, Tone, which is it's actually a step forward for you and I in these fills. We haven't been granted that luxury before, but we've got... we've got a big guest in the form of Frank Woodley.
Oh, a Lane-O-less Woodley.
A Lane-O-less Woodley. He's coming in at 9:30 a.m. this morning to talk about the play Optimism by Tom Wright.
Right.
And it says here things that Tom Wright's written before from the publicist, The Odyssey. That's not true.
That's not one of his. He's just thrown that off because it's out of copyright, probably.
Yeah. Just because you put The Odyssey on the stage, do you reckon Tom gets that? I reckon Tom's angry at the publicist as well. Don't say just The Odyssey.
Let's see if we can get Frank Woodley really fired up about this. Yeah. I'd like to see an angry Frank Woodley.
Well, Frank Woodley's coming in at 9:30. Mm. But before then, we've got a song. This is one that was recommended to you. Recommended to me by you. Because I played a song by
the Felice Brothers
last time.
Yeah.
And you said, play this one by the Felice Brothers.
Let's hear it.
Here it is. That was The Brunettes from New Zealand.
Yes, a bit of New Zealand music. Polyester meets acetate from the album Mars Loves Venus. Before that, the Felice Brothers, Tony.
Yes, that was from their most recent album, Yonder Is the Clock.
There you go.
That came out in 2008, June 2008.
Really? It's that old. Oh, there you go.
This isn't going to be... By the way, if you're sitting there going, is this going to introduce me to like what's happening right now in the music scene over the next two and a... That's what Triple R's done for me over this my life of listening. I'm just going to hang on for these 2.5 hours to find that track that's just been released. I don't know if you should get your hopes too high.
Most of my tracks are from the car. They're from under the passenger seat of the car.
Most of mine are from Fee's CD collection.
Oh, okay.
But then I've been gone for 2 years, and so it's like as though Fee stopped listening to music at the end of 2007.
But we've got the wall of credibility behind us over here at Triple R, so we can reach for that if we have to.
We can. Mm. Absolutely. Now, we are... Tony Wilson and Tony Martin filling in for Tony Biggs on The Blower this Friday. And we've become, I guess, friends over the last year on the back of both being writers or both attempting to be writers and both attempting a second book.
We're both in difficult second book syndrome country at the same time.
Yes. I looked up on the internet when I was sort of searching for... I was actually looking for the title of your next book.
Right.
To see whether there'd been kind of build-up for the fact it's coming in November.
There's very little build-up. Although, actually, I should point out, I have made it into this fancy new book that... because I've been promoted to Picador.
From where?
Just from standard issue Pan Macmillan.
People wouldn't even know that they're the same, are they? Well, Picador and Pan Macmillan.
Yeah,
same.
Well, Picador is like the sort of the posh imprint of Pan Macmillan. So Pan Macmillan's
like the McCafe.
Exactly.
You'd say Picador's like McCafe.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but okay, for this analogy.
And Pan Macmillan is where you get your quarter pounder.
There you
go.
That is very good. It's a very good analogy. But they've put out a sort of a beautifully mounted sort of cardboard book with all their authors.
Yeah.
So you've got like Bret Easton Ellis.
Oh, he's good.
And Delia Falconer, all these proper authors. And then people like me and Charles Firth have been sort of dumped in amongst all the fancy authors. And I'm going, oh, this is great. And look, there's a sort of picture of me.
Yeah.
And there's like a little bio for me, and I'm reading. It's got about the second book coming out. And the last words of this page are, he lives in Sydney.
Oh.
Could they be any more insulting if they try? That's my publishers.
And with the photo there, did you put your finger... anywhere near your chin to look like a proper author? Or
see,
you...
everyone else in the book is looking deadly serious, yeah. Mostly. Even the Bridget Jones Diary woman, semi-serious.
Yeah.
And there's me just grinning like an idiot, like I'm about to give something out of the back of a Black Thunder.
Well, you do choose to be in the humour section. I would actually say, let's get you. I almost would be willing to stage a sort of Great Escape type rescue mission to move you out of humour and into... I don't know. Where do
we put you? Well, see, my books are humour. It says humour on the back. I know what you're saying. I'm in the ghetto along with, golf jokes and Nigel Reese's On Graffiti or whatever.
Yeah.
And Who Farted, basically.
Yeah.
But most bookshops tend to put my book in the biography section for some reason. Because it's, slightly autobiographical.
So but if they were following the instructions on the book, they'd put it in humour.
I'd be in the humour ghetto. Because I've changed a lot of names and things. So I sort of go, in a proper autobiography, you can't do that, can you? You've got to name names and name places. Aren't you? Is that how it's done?
Can't you just change names where you'd get sued? They must do that all the time.
I don't know about that. Ooh. I don't know if it's an actual autobiography.
That's a good question for people who write the little word on the inside of books who haven't been asked a question often directly on radio. But please give us a call if you're in charge of putting on the ISBN number.
Oh, yeah.
And the little
section.
The little guides for the National Library Archive, as in humour, lollies, scrambles, whatever it would have said on the inside of Lolly Scramble. Did you put that in humour because Tony changed some names?
Mm.
Because would it not have belonged in biography?
I don't know. I just don't know what the actual standard is for telling the truth.
But do you like being over there in humour because it's
safe.
A small pond?
It is a small, very dirty pond. But I feel safer being there because of some of the changes I've made and because some of the lies that I tell in my book. Not lies that are disguised.
But normal joke-telling lies.
Normal joke-telling lies.
That any stand-up would tell at any point.
Like I'm talking about, I tell the story of how Skippy... The original Skippy came to our school for a visit and everything went horribly wrong and he had to be put in a bag and thrown in the back of a van.
I met Skippy.
The real one. I'm not sure if this was in Tiqui, New Zealand.
Don't break this to me.
So, no, but this really happened, so that's true.
Yeah.
But then I'll say, when I'm explaining who Skippy was in the book, I'll say that he used to do this and he used to do that, and in one episode he cracked a safe with his paws. Now, that's not true.
Right.
Clearly, that's a joke.
I mean,
I think if you're reading it, you would know that that's a joke. But I think if you were doing a proper autobiography, you wouldn't say that. You know what I mean? You'd only say absolutely true facts,
yeah.
Wouldn't you? So I don't know.
You'd have to have a look at some of the... I mean, for example, James Freud wrote a biography, and I think he was drunk or stoned for the 20 years that he was referring to.
Right.
And so surely it's as shady as the sorts of things you're talking about there.
But I think the idea is if you're writing an autobiography, even if you're stoned and drunk, it's incumbent on you to try and present the facts and not really change the names. You wouldn't say our manager Brian Smith when you meant Michael Gudinski.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know.
The biography section.
Mm.
Sounds like Tony thinks it's true.
So what do you get on the back of? Are you in?
I'm in fiction for players and maybe sporting memoir for Australia United.
But I notice with your novel, it's interesting because sometimes it's in the airport paperback section.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you're in the highfalutin Salman Rushdie end of the
bookshop. They couldn't work it out.
When I was a kid, back in the old days, there was no distinction. There was just fiction. And now we have literary fiction, Salman Rushdie, and then that other sort of, what is it called? Mass market fiction or something. And that's when you're at the airport and you have to put sunglasses on because there's so many Clive Cussler books that the silvery lettering is so dazzling. You know, the silvery lettering section.
I think they were having a buck each way with mine because they went with the look of the book, mass market, as in how good would it be if we all got rich?
Yeah.
And then, but when it didn't, it got reviewed in the Sydney Morning Herald and, got sort of a bit of a literary following.
Yeah, right.
And so... The people who have liked my book tend to have been closer to the highfalutin end because it bashes the footy show.
So as the sales figures dropped, you've slowly been shuffled over to Art House.
Absolutely.
Very nice.
But the cover still sits there going, shouldn't this be over with the ones that go
shouldn't
well?
Should I be with Clive Cussler?
We've got, I was looking you up though about because of Nest of Occasionals to see what was there already. I just found a page that was called Writers Called Tony.
Oh, yeah.
And it said there are 87 writers called Tony, which is a sentence
I loved. Are they including Anthony's? Like Tony Trollope, would he be in there?
No, Anthony Trollope. Oh, I don't think he's... No, he's not there.
Yeah.
So, but you get Tony Robbins.
Oh, yeah.
You know him. He's a life coach, writer, professional speaker. You've got Tony Hawks.
Who's he?
English comedian and author.
Oh, I don't know who that is.
You've got a guy called Tony Millionaire.
He's
an American cartoonist, illustrator and author, known for a syndicated comic strip called Markies.
Right.
You've got Tony Gregg.
Oh, yeah.
He's the cricket writer. So they're not exactly saying you've got to have, you know, got a grant from the federal government for literature here. It really is any writer called Tony. They've got a Tony
Park, the African, you know, writes books about elephants and things. He'd be in there.
Yeah, he is. Tony Shaw's in there, the ex-captain of Collingwood.
All right.
And there's also a Tony Wilson in there.
Another one?
Yeah.
How many do we need? Oh, hang on. Actually, that's true because I was in the bookshop and I saw a book I thought you had written about Chappelle Corby.
There's three other famous Tony Wilsons. The Colossus, Factory Records. Then there's a guy playing football in America called Tony Wilson.
Yeah.
And then there is Chappelle Corby's primary advocate. He's the big defender of Chappelle Corby, and he's called Tony Wilson as well. So there's four of us out there muscling away on Google.
Wow. And yep. Tony Wilson, of course, the Factory Records Tony Wilson, played by Steve Coogan in that film. What was it called?
24-Hour Party People.
You know, because he's known for doing Alan Partridge.
Yeah.
But did you know that Alan Partridge was kind of based on Tony Wilson?
Really?
Because Steve Coogan used to do an impression of Tony Wilson. He was quite famous for it in the 80s. And then he sort of morphed Tony Wilson into Alan Partridge. But then he played Tony Wilson in 24-Hour Party People. But then to make it even weirder, in that film The Cock and Bull Story, Tristram Shandy, the real Tony Wilson interviews Steve Coogan playing himself about what it must be like to be trapped in the character of Alan Partridge.
when that's really Tony Wilson.
So how confusing is that?
That is.
That does your head in thinking about that.
Well,
tackling the big ones, the two times.
Yeah, and it is. 22 minutes to 10. We have our guest. I billed him for 9:30, and with a relaxation that would never have happened in the Lano and Woodley days, Frank Woodley has bowled in at 9:38, and he's comfortable and happy and ready to go. I'm going to play a track, and then we're going to talk to him. So stick around for Frank Woodley.
Well, you are quite simply the nicest person in the world, aren't you? So why haven't you subscribed, you miserable bastard?
You're listening to Triple R and you're listening to On the Blower. Tony Biggs sick this week, and Tony Martin and Tony Wilson filling in for him, the two tones. Just to throw in a little bit more Anthony flavour, we had Anthony and the Johnsons with You Are My Sister from the album of the same name.
I've got a sister called Tony.
Here it comes. We're going to hear more on that. And after that, we heard Jacob, a New Zealand outfit from maybe 3 or 4 years ago. Nice Day for an Earthquake, the name of the track. The voice you just heard, Frank Woodley, we pre-announced him. The play he is doing at the Malthouse from May 22 to June 13, Optimism by Voltaire. No, not by Voltaire, by Tom Wright, based on something by Voltaire.
Yeah. There's a famous book by Voltaire called Candide, written around the 1700s. And a very full-on, famous kind of black comedy. I'm not sure, but it feels like it might have been one of the first full-on black comedies, this book, because it's like just ridiculously dark. You know, there's characters talk about, you know, being pack raped in the fundament and being disemboweled and going, but you know, the good thing is we did the same thing to the Bulgarians. Sort of, you know, it's kind of totally.
And would that have been a cack fest in the 17 whatevers?
Well, I think so. I think it was a novel. And I think it might have been banned because it was very satirical and sort of, you know, suggested that the church got up to some naughty things and stuff like that, and as well as royalty and so forth. But
and the Bulgarians wouldn't have been happy.
No, I don't think so. It actually sold like hotcakes in Bulgaria, but they hate hotcakes there. So it's a cultural thing. I don't understand it. I love hotcakes myself. Yeah, I like warm cakes, even cold cakes. But
cold cakes up the fundament at our place.
So Tom Wright has rewritten Voltaire's Candide, and so it's like a play I'm in.
We very controversially, Frank, when before you came in, you do all your snide remarks around the side of a production before the guest comes in, but we're going to bring you in on it here.
Okay, good.
What did we
Tom
say?
Wright, Tom Wright in the publicity blurb after his name, open brackets, The Odyssey, close brackets, as in. So sort of like he'd written The Odyssey.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas we don't even know that much about classics, but we didn't think Tom Wright deserved the credit for that.
No, but we've got what do you call the psychic? There's a psychic who apparently Tom Wright was Homer. They've done it. They've worked it out. It's legit.
Okay.
He really was. So, you know, he was an Egyptian pharaoh, and then he was Homer as well, apparently.
Excellent. Well, it sounds like an amazing production. Where's it on?
Hang on, I'll just hang shit on the author. But it sounds like an amazing production. Where's it on? And get out.
No, you don't have to get out. We can talk about other stuff as well.
No, it's on at the Malt House in about 2 weeks, which is quite soon.
And Frank, how are you feeling mixing it with the serious actors? Do you feel at home because of your years on the stage?
Well, we're up there rehearsing, and you know, I was doing a scene with Barry Otto. You know Barry Otto.
Oh, he's
like,
you know,
and
I'm thinking, well, that's what I'm thinking. I'm doing reading this scene with him, and I'm thinking, you know, a scene that's got both, you know, one of Australia's greatest actors of all time and Barry Otto. I mean, this is a terrific. That's a Ricky Gervais joke. Actually, he did about Robert De Niro.
But I just go.
Why not appropriate it there?
Well, you did the right thing because Tone is, I think, conducting a Nuremberg Court of Comedy for any stolen material. At the end of your career, aren't you going
to
have a?
Well, no. This was a thing. Russell Gilbert. Mick Mallor used to live with Russell Gilbert, and so I think it was about 1989. Russell Gilbert has. I don't know if you know Russell, Frank, but he has an incredible collection of comedy albums.
Right.
Like Glen A. Baker will go around and just, you know, sort of enviously eye up the collection. So Gilbo is very good at spotting a steal. and I used to be able to spot a steal pretty well too. But like we sort of talked one night about having the comedy Nuremberg, and it would happen like 20 years from now. And it's actually 20 years this year, I think.
But I have written a number of jokes that I have definitely written, right? Absolutely, no question. I've come up with this idea, and then I've sat down and I've seen Harpo Marx do it.
And well,
I've gone, I've got to get my manager on the phone. This is an outrage. You know, it's.
But a lot of the times, it's just that's the only joke to be made on that topic.
Yeah,
like we did one on Get this radio show I did where there was a town in America where they were making sex offenders wear T-shirts saying, I'm a sex offender.
Yep.
So they had to wear them wherever they go. So what are the jokes you would do? The obvious jokes are, could you get someone else to wear it with, I'm with a sex offender?
Right.
Yeah.
Or maybe, I heart sex offending. Right. And so we did that on the radio. And 2 weeks later, those exact same two T-shirts were held up on the chaser.
Right.
And you're going, now that's not because they stole it, because they wouldn't, because... Yeah.
They've sat around and gone, what's the
what
territory?
Are
and
the it's like, you the know, obvious it's like, T-shirt jokes.
I used to work selling, like delivering sandwiches early on.
Right.
And every time you would get in a lift, if you're taking them to offices, the lift doors would close. And if there was more than, there needed to be about at least four people in the lift. And someone would say, well, at least if the lift breaks down, we'll have something to eat. Every time, you know. And I would graciously go, Yeah.
Because whoever, you know, that person would think they're the first person absolutely. To have ever said it.
Yeah. So so the Nuremberg comedy trials, will some people will go down innocently, for sure.
People are welcome to call over the course of today with the default joke in their line of work or in their workplace.
Yeah, right.
Default they hear jokes. 1,000 times a day.
I quite like that idea of compiling that list. So it can also mean that we can ward people off. Yeah. Don't say it. Please don't say it.
Cross them off the list.
And of course, names are very obvious for that as well.
Like, yeah, when you make a joke about somebody's name.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you've probably heard that, haven't you?
Yeah.
Do you think Barry Otto's ever heard that if he changed his name to Erie Otto, Y-R-R-Y, he'd have a perfect palindrome? He'd be our greatest palindromic actor.
Erie Otto.
He'd have to be Y-R-R-Y, which is,
oh,
I think...
really?
Yeah.
See, nobody... I'd never heard of that name before.
Erie.
Erie. You've...
No, there isn't.
Couldn't you have just said Bob? That would have worked. What's it? Y-R-R-Y? That's not a word or a name. What are you talking about?
Yeah, you know what? I'm fairly confident he's never heard
he
that
hasn't,
joke
which
before.
Which is why I'll be sparkling company around Erie Otto and you guys won't.
But hey, I'll tell you something about Barry Otto. He does have, I think, a son whose name is Socrates Otto.
That's
a highfalutin actor's name.
Is.
And then Michael Caton, he has a son called, who's also, you'll see on your Blue Heelers type, you know, shows, Septimus Caton.
Is he named after a Transformer? Septimus Prime?
It sounds a little bit like a Transformer that's got a bloodborne disease.
Yeah.
I don't know if they can get them.
Transformers maybe born. They're...
But, hey, I'm here to talk about a play that I'm in that the publicist will wrap my knuckles if I don't mention it at all
optimism.
When I get home.
Let's go optimism crazy, Melbourne. now, hang on. I should just say, sorry, Tony, that when you were playing with the CD player before and you said that the song is called something about earthquakes.
Yes, nice day for an earthquake.
Frank piped up with very appropriate for my play. Why is that so?
Well, because the story is about this this chap called Candide who lives a kind of an idyllic life in a castle. He's sort of, you get the feeling that he's maybe on a scholarship there or something like that. He's not actually one of the aristocrats, but he's kind of in the gang. And then he has a little liaison with the daughter of the baron and he gets kicked out of the castle. And he's naturally a very optimistic person. Sees every day is a nice day as far as he's concerned. But then... and this is the kind of the idea, Voltaire's original idea. He basically puts him through a series of the most horrific experiences a human being can go through. So he gets press ganged into an army at the start, and then he's involved in a natural disaster, an earthquake.
Right.
3 hours on hold with Telstra.
Exactly. Plagues, whatever. You know, the whole thing. Syphilis. He gets the swine flu, although he treats that with some ointment.
Hello!
all right, sorry. That's one of those jokes that everyone's making.
You guys are two weeks away, aren't you? From are you allowed to keep... Is that still going through the last buffing as to whether that's going to be allowed to stay?
Absolutely. I'm determined. That's in, for sure. That's the only thing I'm truly confident about, to be honest with you. But it's very much that a nice day for an earthquake. I mean, that's kind of his whole... experience
ethos.
Is
how, you know, and I guess what is the modern version of that we have in...
And it seems to me that it's exactly the same. Exactly the same issue applies now that applied when it was written, which is, you know, is optimism really... is it just delusion, considering, you know, ultimately your body's going to rot around you and then you're going to die and everyone you know is going to die and you're going to experience horrific suffering? And, of course, you know, there's lots of wonderful experiences in life, but is it possible... Like, is optimism a kind of a crucial delusion that we keep to sort of, you know, get up in the morning and push on and make the most of it? Or is it actually just ridiculous? Or is it the truth? You know, like what? So it seems like
what's the right answer? Is it, you got it at the end?
Don't
give
away the ending.
In the end, we all go and live on the moon happily forever. No, the play sort of doesn't give a pat answer. It sort of takes you through all these experiences, and then there's this kind of motley crew at the end. They're not 80s rock.
No, you wouldn't need that.
Of people who have kind of been through, shared a whole lot of experiences, and they kind of just all look at each other and go, a bit. But then there's a famous bit at the end where they start working in a garden at the end, which there's a whole lot of conjecture in our rehearsals about just how pat that is and kind of tacked on as a sweet little experience at the end. or is it an incredibly profound, poetic, you know, idea?
Do you reckon they needed to drag him back? Do you think in the Voltaire, for example, is it that closely based on the original book?
Yeah, it's pretty close. And
so, do you think he lost his audience and they had to sort of give him that last
the happy note? Ending? The producers got involved and
not the LA Confidential ending where it just ends. It properly ends, you know, with the car coming in and holding up the badge, and then someone's gone, "Oh no, Russell Crowe's dead. We need to bring him back." And there's that great thing where it doesn't matter how many times you've been shot in a movie, if you just have your arm in a sling in the next scene, fine, survived.
Right.
Got through it.
So I think I might have my arm in a sling in this production based on that.
That's a good idea.
You're sore, aren't you, at the moment? Is that true?
I am, because I was mucking around and I did 3/5 of a back somersault.
No.
Not anywhere near a big enough fraction, as it turns out. I reckon 2/5 would have been all right, probably. Even 4/5 would have been good.
You've done somersaults in your sleep, Frank Woodley.
Yeah, I was trying to improve my technique. Right. And what have we learned? Once you've got something that works, just stick with it. Don't try to get that extra 2 inches higher off the ground. Yeah, so I have actually damaged my shoulder a little bit.
Do you reckon there'll be... Can you pencil in into the dim and pessimistic future a day when you can't do a somersault? Do you reckon 55 or 52 or 63?
Well, I can't do one now because of my shoulder.
No, but,
so assuming my shoulder comes good, but
talking about the ravages of aging, really,
I've got to get some kind of stunt double involved, clearly, or work out a catchphrase. Like I need a catchphrase, like you know, I don't know what it would be, but oh my goodness, I didn't even eat the avocado or something.
Yeah,
and then just I'd like to be able to just come out slowly on a walking frame to applause.
Yeah,
you know, it takes me about 3 minutes to get to the middle of the stage. Oh my goodness, I didn't even eat the avocado. Massive laugh.
Bang!
And then just off on the walking frame again. That's what I'm looking forward to.
I tell you, the answer is because I went and saw James Brown live it was probably 10 years ago. It was a New Year's Eve in San Francisco. And he's like, it's the hardest working cummerbund in show business.
Yes.
And he's standing there and it's getting to the bit where he's going to have to do some dancing. Going, is he going to still be able to do the splits? And when that bit occurred, he just suavely stepped over to one of the amps, leaned on it, and then went like this to the side of stage, and out came four incredibly hot women in bikinis with the American flag on, and they just did all of his usual gear.
Yeah.
And then they went off, and then he walked back and went on. So you could do...
And obviously a comedy somersault by a beautiful woman in bikini is going to get some sort of extra boobage falling out
or
something.
That's going to be on the internet instantly.
Yeah. Yeah, so, that's the way to go. No, look, I'm pretty optimistic, actually, about... In fact, you know, I'm a kind of... I think I'm a glass... half full kind of person, although I have a niggling feeling it's half full of poison. But I do think that, you know, I'll be able to do somersaults until... I'm going to somersault into the grave. That's my plan.
It's a beautiful vision. The play is Optimism. The writer, Tom Wright, I didn't mean to offend him at any point over this interview. He wrote the
Iliad too, I think.
He did. Yeah. The theatre is the Malthouse, and it is running in the Merlin from May 22nd to June 13th.
He did some editing on all of Shakespeare's stuff too with him, sat down with Shakespeare, just went through. He doesn't claim to have written stuff, but he gave it a good going over.
So he did it with Marlowe.
Yeah, Marlowe. Okay. Him and Marlowe, and then they came up. He came up with the name Shakespeare.
Right. Okay.
He did a joke run through it.
Yeah,
and
that's
it's
right.
being produced. It up. To, just to get an idea of where this is going to be going, it's going to be huge. I don't know if Frank's going the whole way with it, but the Malthouse, Edinburgh Festival are involved, Sydney Festival and the Sydney Theatre Company also involved. So this has, you know, some bicep behind it.
And it's going to be... It's definitely not going to be the kind of show that I normally do that is just a strict comedy show. It's sort of a very bizarre, dreamlike, theatrical kind of experience. But hopefully, you look at it and you go, I'm glad I did.
Yeah, and he gives it to the Bulgarians too, so stay tuned for that. It's Tony Martin, Tony Wilson, filling in for Tony Biggs. Thank you very much, Frank Woodley, for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Tone Eyes.
We got Pavement.
Yeah.
That was Pavement from an album of a while back, wasn't it?
That's from the Wowie Zowie album. That would be Motion Suggests Itself, and really just playing that in honour of our late friend Mr. Richard Marsland, who wonderful Melbourne broadcaster who came up in the, there's no other way of putting it, in the dead person montage on the Logies on Sunday night, and Richard would have found that hilarious. He would have.
Just a terrible bit of news, and Yeah, one of those doesn't really get much easier as the months roll on.
No, it doesn't. Still very odd.
Quite it sort of sits in your mobile phone. Can't actually make the step to.
I've done the same thing. I still have Richard on speed dial.
Yeah, and he's right next to you as well in the alphabetical division. So whenever I call you, that's why I always sound so flat.
No,
it's absolutely dreadful. And you were involved in his funeral.
I was. I had something happened that Richard again would have found hilarious, and that is, it was a beautiful funeral, massive crowd of people because it was open to the general public in Adelaide. So fans of Richard's various projects showed up, and the press were there, and so it was a packed house. And people were doing eulogies. Marty Sheargold did an amazing eulogy, and Richard's sister did an amazing eulogy. And then the priest went, "And now, with another eulogy, please welcome Tony Martin." And no one had told me. And it was like that dream where which Frank was just talking about off air, where you can't remember your first line in the play, where you're on stage nude and you don't know your lines. And so I had to get up and improvise 10 minutes about Richard, which I did, but I was talking absolute rubbish at one point.
And it's sort of, it would be almost your greatest nightmare, because people have always said, if anything, you've been a very, very meticulous preparer career.
Well, if I'd known, I would have written something, you know, elaborate in memory of Richard, but I was just standing there waffling on about, at one point, how's this in a eulogy in a church? I was plugging a podcast. I was directing people to iTunes because we'd done a tribute podcast for Richard, which is still up there, by the way. If you type Richard Marsland Lives into iTunes, you'll hear a fantastic tribute to him. But that was bizarre. And then I got up and there were quotes from me in the Adelaide Advertiser the next morning, which I don't remember actually saying. And so for the whole rest of the funeral, I was just like in shock. It was like in the episode of Father Ted kicking Bishop Brennan up the arse. Yeah. When Bishop Brennan gets kicked up the arse and he's not sure if it's happened, he's just standing there and he goes on a plane and he's meeting the Pope and he's still stunned. Yeah. That was what I was like for the whole rest of the funeral.
But a lot of people told me it went really well. And in fact, do you reckon it was almost a blessing in some respects?
It is. I tell you what it is that everyone else was reading off paper, and because I was just talking and looking at people, there's sort of a weird kind of power to that.
Yeah.
Even though I didn't know what I was saying, people were sort of compelled because here was somebody who wasn't reading it out. So that kind of, I think that I got away with it because of that.
Yeah.
But that is, imagine that in a church with 1,000 people and you have to speak for 10 minutes and you've prepared nothing.
Is it difficult for a comedian, someone who's done almost all their public speaking has involved
getting laughs,
having to get laughs, and then suddenly you go, do you have to switch something off almost say that this is inappropriate here for me to make a joke that Richard would find very funny and might be the sort of thing that Richard would love to have at his funeral.
Yeah.
But you just is sort of like, well, come on, let's get it together. We're not going to make a,
I wasn't standing around with Marty Sheargold afterwards saying, well, I think I killed, the opening was strong, but I was doing old rope. But there was, I have to say, and it, you know, I don't mean this, it's, I don't want to offend people who know Richard, but it was a hilarious funeral. They had a giant television screen set up and they showed a montage of clips of Richard on the Ann Wills Adelaide morning program, and I have to say it killed. It brought the house, it brought the church down. And also, I found myself just telling funny stories about Richard because there are so many. So, yeah, it was certainly the oddest gig I've ever done.
Well, he will be sadly missed, and it's awful when, because those get this podcast, and they're also up on the internet in various spots, I think.
They just go around. They constantly go around.
It makes them very hard, I obviously love them and have them all, but makes it very hard to listen to some of them just to
I know, I can't.
To know he's not there.
Mm.
We mentioned James Brown before. I've got a James Brown track here. I thought I'd play it. It actually gets referred to in my next novel. You'll have to make it all the way to chapter.
I have to say I've read your next novel, Tony, and it's a corker.
It's not out yet if anyone else wants to read it, unless I send you a Microsoft Word file. So, but Papa's got a brand new bag, unless it is one of the 20,000 words that gets cut over the next 2 months.
Losing 20,000, are you,
Tony? Yeah, got to lose the 20,000.
All right, okay. Just a bit off the sides.
Yeah, here it is.
Hello, I'm Claudia Carvin and Triple R Rules.
That was a go-between tribute song from an album.
That's
Pardon me, I'm feeling its head off, Mike, today.
Here I am.
It's from Write Your Adventures Down, the tribute album to the Go-Betweens, which Dave McCormack kind of organised from a couple of years ago, and that was Adele Pickvans doing Finding You. Adele, I know Adele as a bass player in Dave Graney's band for quite a few years, and in the last incarnation of the Go-Betweens. I didn't know she could sing. How good is that?
That's beautiful.
That's a beautiful one.
And might I just say that off-micness was a lot of people think that was just sloppy from me, but actually it was my tribute, because you just have been speaking about Richard Marsland, and I did not want to show Richard Marsland up, one of the great button pushers.
He was, I mean, in 2 years, he made one mistake, literally one panelling mistake on our show, and you can imagine how long he was apologising for that.
So it was pens down for me here. I wasn't even trying. No, that's why it ended up so sloppy.
It was a tribute, a salute.
It is 21 minutes past 10. You are listening to The Two Tones, and if I say that with enough gravitas, it could become a show title. We're filling in for Tony Biggs, who's sick this week on The Blower, and we will be going onto The Blower after 10:30. We're willing to have that courage and look forward to greeting the listener. And so we need some things to talk about.
Well, I think a big topic in the news today is the internet. Will people pay for internet content that they've previously got for free? Rupert Murdoch. I don't know if people know Rupert Murdoch. You'll often see photos of him in the paper. He sort of looks like a melted candle dusted with Ovaltine is how I would describe him.
And what was the great quote directed at him from the writer of The Singing Detective, Dennis Potter?
Dennis Potter did tell Melvin Bragg shortly before he died that his one regret in life is that he hadn't walked up to Rupert Murdoch and shot him dead. In fact, he put it a lot more violently than that.
I hope that when I'm in my last few months, I show similar joie de vivre and liberation.
That's right. Not worrying what bridges you're burning. But listen to this today. News Corp chairman Rupert Murdoch is determined to charge readers for the online content of his newspapers, and says they'll be paying sooner rather than later.
Ooh.
And he points out that he reckons this could work. People would pay to read the Herald Sun online because the Wall Street Journal, which is, I don't know what that is, that's like the Financial Review, is it?
Yeah.
Right, so that's...
He owns it. He's got it.
Okay, that has proved that people will pay. Now, the kind of people who read the Wall Street Journal are probably willing to pay for some kind of, you know, information that's going to make them more money. Will the average person pay to read the Herald Sun online, do you think?
There are days when I would.
Yeah.
Like, for example, the day they ran the headline about... there was a man, an Aboriginal bloke, who was selling didgeridoos in club colours, and he'd been told not to do that.
Really?
And so, Herald Sun, didgeridoo-don't.
Didgeridoo-don't.
That's worth $1.50 to see that.
Well, what about recently when it was the front of the Herald Sun was shame? It was another shame, and it was the shame of... Now, I don't know about football, Tony, but I understand that recently some footballers made a film where they were having sex with a chicken or something.
Yeah.
Or maybe a chicken was having sex with something else.
The Adventures of Boris was the name of the film.
Right.
Probably you'll have to, as a bit of an IMDb buff, I'll try and find out who did the lighting on it.
It was very poor lighting from what I understand.
But the great little, I mean, this is all old news, but
yeah,
they had the sponsors placard in the background.
Oh, well done.
Congratulations. Their own locker was there, so you could see on the number on the locker, they hadn't moved two lockers along to effectively dub in their teammate. Whoever's production manager, when you're putting that one in, bad job.
But what you've got on the front of the Herald Sun is shame, families, children. It's a disgrace. It should never have happened. It's disgusting. Then you open the Herald Sun and there's a huge box. Watch the video. Go to heraldsun.com.
Yeah.
That's a moral quandary, I would have thought.
So would you pay for anything online? Okay, start rattling off the things that you would pay for that you currently get for free.
I don't know. I don't know that there is anything, because you can always find a free version. Someone is going to have cut and pasted, you know, such and such into a forum where you can read it for free. I mean, I go, what I love about newspapers on the internet is you no longer have to read the Herald Sun. You can read the New York Times, or you can read the Guardian. You can go around the grounds and read a lot of quality journalism for free.
So they'd have to really get the cartel together to make it work.
I mean, I'm surprised, really, in a way, that anybody buys a newspaper, because you can read pretty much all of The Age and The Sun for free on the internet, can't you?
You know, did you notice... Oh, you wouldn't have noticed because it has sport in the general theme, but there's a glossy that comes out on every third Monday or something with The Age called Something in Style, and it's like a sports magazine, really high quality pictures, not necessarily high quality articles.
Right.
But this week, all that, have you heard all that Demir Dokic stuff where he's going to fire a rocket launcher?
Someone's going to drop a rocket launcher out the front of his house if he just snaps his fingers, apparently.
And he's going to take out the Australian ambassador in Belgrade. And he's actually been detained for it. He's actually doing a little bit of time.
It's the first time I've heard of someone actually behaving like a Batman villain, actually announcing what they're going to do beforehand, you know, in the form of a riddle.
And I'm bringing this up not to get all the salacious tabloid glitter that comes from this story, which is great. But the really interesting thing I thought was that it came out, that story came on the back of Jelena Dokic, not in the newspaper, being interviewed for a feature article. She was it was in the glossy magazine. It was like an exclusive being broken from the newspaper, the sort of thing. I was beaten by my father, the sort of thing that would normally front page it. That was in an interview in their glossy magazine.
Wow.
And it's kind of like the new era, because newspapers, as you've probably noticed, are getting so thin in the book.
Yeah.
That they're now trying to make reasons why you'd have a subscription, and it's all this value added stuff, like the Melbourne magazine, I think, comes out once a month on a Friday, and now they've added a sports magazine.
Right.
And so one question would be is, are people stopping buying newspapers? Would they continue to buy newspapers to get all this kind of value added stuff?
Yeah, and let's get people to just tell us what is out there on the internet that maybe we don't know about, that we should be having a look at.
And
YouTube, I see in the paper, listen to this, YouTube is, you would think that would be a massively successful site, but how do they make money off YouTube? Is there advertising? I've never noticed.
I'm not sure.
I know there's talk about putting a little 5-minute advert on the front of every clip.
5 minutes?
Is it 5 minutes? Sorry, 5 second.
Do that on The Age now.
Yeah, but I mean, that's interesting, because with YouTube, firstly, you've got a lot of in breach of copyright content on there, which is one of the main reasons people go there, to watch bits from TV shows.
So they'd have to go into every piece.
I reckon the party would be over if they started putting ads on the front of some of those clips, because the copyright holder for...
So you guys know about this then, do you? Because you bothered to put a... Unless it was an automatic thing. If YouTube could argue that anything that ever gets uploaded just has a
on the front
thing tacked on, so we didn't see it, it's not our fault.
Well, see, I would have thought they would be making a lot of money somehow, because it's such a massively successful site. But listen to this. YouTube is on track to lose $470 million this year thanks to outrageously high operating costs and a poor business plan. What, outrageously high? Are they just on a bad server, do you think? What are they doing?
They must be paying the guy who has to remove Disney clips. They must be paying him $1.3 billion a year.
Is it storage? Is it? I mean, because I don't understand how YouTube works. Is the story, when you put a clip up, is it stored at your place and people are accessing it like a file?
No, it's
going to them.
I think so. I think, uploading is sending it to them.
Well, I think that's what's blowing.
They're paying a lot. There's obviously, they'd need some. They'd need more than a C drive. You'd need a D and an E as well, wouldn't you?
They'd need broadband. But there's, talk is that, YouTube might be, the fun might be over there within the next year. And I know young people. I know some young people, Tony, who, if there was no YouTube, life would pretty much cease to exist for them.
But you have a YouTube regime. That's why I was thinking you might say that you'd pay for YouTube. The day after a show you like in the UK goes to air there, you grab it lunchtime on the Tuesday or something?
Well, there was a show recently. I'm a big fan of Stuart Lee, the British stand-up comedian, and he did a 6-part series, Stuart Lee's Comedy Vehicle, and went out on Monday night on the BBC, and pretty much by midday Tuesday our time, it was up there. Each episode would be up in three 10-minute blocks. So I've watched that show. So, it could be argued that I've cost someone a lot of money because maybe I won't buy the DVD now because I've watched it on YouTube. Or, yeah. And presumably I can still watch it on YouTube in 6 months' time. So, yeah, I mean, I'm one of these people who will use YouTube as a sort of audition for whether I'm going to buy a DVD.
And Comedy Festival as well. You went through the program, and almost everyone's up there.
Yeah, that's right. You get the Comedy Festival program. There's all these comedians from England that you've never heard of. And, of course, every one of them has a 4-star review, the hit of Edinburgh, so you don't know who's good and who's bad. And, like, yeah, I would just sit there, you know, typing their names in and watching clips of them.
So what would you pay a month for that? Would you pay $3 a month? $8 a month? $100 a month?
I don't think I'd pay $100. I might pay $20 a month to watch YouTube. I haven't thought about that till this moment.
And have you ever gone over? Because, like you say, if anyone makes you pay, didn't this happen at Napster or something like that? That they introduced as soon as these free download sites are made to charge in order to cover the copyright owners, it just moves over to the next illegal one.
Yeah, exactly, a pirate version.
So. There are a lot of YouTubes now, aren't there? Like, there's high definition YouTube that's called something else, isn't there?
There's several hundred porno versions of YouTube. I know that.
Yeah. So that's our question. We'll after what's good on the internet, what you'd pay for, maybe stuff you're already paying for, and Rupert Murdoch's prospects of getting you to pay for the Herald Sun online or the Super Footy site. We've got a couple of callers on the line. I reckon on line one, we've got Andrew. And
I hope it's not Andrew Bolt.
Hello, Andrew. Is it Andrew Bolt?
No, it's not Andrew Bolt.
How are you, Andrew?
I'm good, thank you. Is that the two Tonys I'm speaking to?
Yes, it's filling in for that? A Tony. So we're just awash with them at the moment.
Twins, but not twins. I used to work for Mr. Murdoch.
Yeah. Good boss.
I freelanced for a few years back in the days when the Australian took freelance contributions to half a dozen columns they ran.
Yeah.
I was a regular contributor to one called Perspective.
Right.
And in the motoring section.
Excellent.
And it was terrific. I had a lot of fun doing it. I reckon I wrote some pretty reasonable stuff. The editors wanted to keep me on as a regular. They commissioned a few pieces.
Yeah.
And then Perspective was dropped as a column, just disappeared. And I had a fair sort of an idea that a lot of people looked forward to reading the Perspective column every week because it wasn't a column written by regular columnists. You could hear different voices. You know, every week there was someone from out of the blue. And people looked forward to that. The same with the motoring section. It was instead of the rest of the motoring section being just about car reviews, this was about the culture of motoring.
Well, I must say, I got dragged into a show that was probably a spin-off of your section in the Australian, because we had a Dimensions on the Move, and I was the obligatory tall blonde bloke who didn't know anything about cars and had to do the stories on the big tractors and the tanks and the huge mine trucks over in WA. It was that whole idea that things that move aren't just the new edition of the Commodore.
Yeah, and they're not just oil and pistons going up and down.
So would you pay for some good motoring on the net, or would you pay for the Australian, Andrew?
Well, can I tell you what happened after they dropped both these columns?
Yeah.
A motoring column as well. They started another column in another part of the paper that they're still running at the moment. So I sent in a piece to that, and the editor rang me up and said, this is good, we'll take this. But do you realise that we don't pay for this particular column?
Oh, right. Really?
And I said, I said, look, I've been contributing for about 6 years now, and I've been paid for my work. I consider myself a professional.
Yeah.
Does Rupert need a new yacht this week? Why should I give my work to a billionaire? And the editor said, well,
hang on.
I understand. I really do, and I'll understand if you don't wish to give it to us. And I said, well, no, I don't.
It is. We're actually losing Andrew. And it's
no,
not
no,
even
it's
us.
It's someone else trying to call through. But it's not, that was the last of my relationship with the Australian and Mr. Murdoch in particular.
Well, it just does show he has the capacity to make a buck, and it's good to see that in his 70s he hasn't let off at all. Can we say thank you to Andrew for
thanks,
for that?
Andrew. I wonder if Andrew was subjected to some of the advice that people who write for Rupert Murdoch's papers get. And I understand there was an editor in England a few years ago who said that the advice in regards to the general public was "Keep them angry, keep them stupid." That's beautiful. That become quite a famous quote.
Well, on line two, Steve is there. Can you hear us, Steve? Hello, Steve? Oh, hang on. Oh, hello, Steve. You there? Might have lost Steve.
Steve.
We'll go over to three and Justin. Justin.
Hello, Tony's.
How are you?
How are you?
Good
Very
to
well.
Hear from you.
I was hoping you could adjudicate something for me.
Yeah.
I think it was December, you were on the radio talking about how you read 100 books in a year.
Yeah, well, that was encouraged by Stephen King.
Right. My wife and I are doing a similar thing, and we set 40 books for the year. But she's been reading these Stephanie Meyer ones, and I just wanted to know if you consider them on the list.
Well, they're not picture books, are they? I mean, my trouble was I threw a couple of Glenn Baxter's in, which are technically cartoon books, so I eliminated, you know, picture books from it, but... I mean, I haven't read any of these Stephanie Meyer books, but they're pretty much like 7 of the top 10 is them, and it's
500 pages long, aren't they?
Yeah, but they're pretty easy reads. I mean, you know, I could read the form guide and say, "Hey, there's one."
The form guide.
I reckon. I sort of know what you mean, but I also think that one of the great underrated skills in writing is page turning. What will happen next? Storytelling.
Yeah.
And that Stephanie may be making you almost. Throw up with her quality of prose, but the fact that all these kids just want to finish every one of her books and buy the next one, she has something of what writing is all about. So I'd count her books.
So how is this affecting the total? I mean, what's the score at this point?
Well, I think she's well ahead. I mean, she's been powering through these ones and then reading a few of the Sookie Stackhouse ones from the True Blood series.
And whereas, what are you tackling?
Why don't you read the liner notes of
Let the right one in, and a couple of Pelicanos, things like that.
Oh, Pelicanos, very nice.
And in Christos as the slap, can you give us your three votes for most dislikable character? It's a fairly packed field.
Probably the kid.
The kid, yeah.
Kid cops it.
I thought this is probably going to be speaking out of turn, and Sam Pang may be currently texting me, telling me not to say this, but he said... that he wished the book had been called The Kick. So I thought that was... That sort of summed up my feelings for the kid as well.
Very nice.
I think we're going to have to accept the Stephanie Meyer as contributing to the 40. But good luck getting to the 40, Justin.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justin. And might I just say that, as Justin has amply exemplified, you can call on any topic. We have thrown the internet up as a general idea, but do just throw up anything if you like. On line four, we have Joey. Hello, Joey.
Good morning, Tony. How are you going?
Good. How are you?
Good, thank you. I'm with the Growling Frogs. We're an organisation who's building a children's resort in King Lake.
Now, this is. I knew you were going to call, Joey, and I had no notification that it was actually you, or else I would have given you a more spectacular intro. But yeah, give us an idea of the Growling Frogs and what you're up to.
Okay, well, we're an organisation of volunteers, and some of us are educators and some of us are entertainers, and we've come together after the fires, and we're trying to put together some things for the kids of the fire-affected areas to help them get through all of this. And right now we're building a children's retreat at King Lake. And the Triple R listeners have been fabulous. I'd like to say thank you to Duncan from Planet Earthworks. He's going to do the cutting and preparing at the site so we can put up the building there. And we're looking for some more helpers, so I was hoping that you guys could help us with that today.
Excellent. Well, if anyone wants to be a helper, and so what sort of things do you need? Do you need tradies, and you need entertainers, and you need what else?
Oh, we need everything, but specifically today we're looking for someone to help with the plumbing. Firstly, to help us fit the pans and the washcloths, etc., in the building at Dandenong, where the portal was coming from, and secondly, to help plumb the building when it gets to the site at King Lake. And we're also looking for some electrical workers to help connect the pre-wired buildings to the existing site and install some AC units.
And if people respond to this, will they be allowed to refer to themselves as being part of the Growling Frogs?
They certainly can, yes.
All right, that's the icing on the cake, I would have thought.
Ribbit, ribbit.
And is the Growling Frog a local frog up there? I've heard of a golf course called Growling Frog, so I'm assuming it is around here somewhere.
The Growling Frog is actually a frog who's quite resilient to fire.
Ah.
Where our name came from.
A fireproof frog.
Somewhat, yes.
Good on you, nature.
So we're also looking for some people to help us with the landscaping. We need some asphalting for the play area to go outside the childcare centre, and some astroturf, and also some suitable garden plants.
Wow.
This is. What do you think of me just naming names here when you know someone and say, you're up for that, Bushy?
Yeah, that's right.
I'd be happy with that.
Yeah, I think you just dob them in. It's a great idea.
And what do people do if they want to get on board?
They could contact us at info@growlingfrogs.com.
That's info@growlingfrogs.com.
Or if they want to contact Triple R, I'm sure you guys can forward their details to us, can you?
Yes, and that number, and people are calling it for such frivolous reasons as telling us whether they'd pay for a Herald Sun pun on the front page, because Rupert Murdoch's threatening that. That number is 9388 1027. So if you're a growling frogger, just tell whoever answers the phone that that's what you are, and that you're going to help up at King Lake for the kids.
Plumbers, electrical workers and asphalters.
Landscapers. And I think they'd also like
and
to hear from...
general labourers of all types.
It's going to be beautiful.
Can I just, before I go, thank the Tsuchi Buddhist Foundation, who are actually making this building be possible, and the Lions Club at King Lake.
No, we couldn't possibly mention those organisations.
You should put them together for a barbecue. I'd like to see the Buddhists and the Lions just co-mingling there.
Vegetarian barbecue for
yeah.
the Buddhists.
Cool.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Joey, for for calling us up. And, yes, that detail again was info@growlingfrog.com.
Growling Frogs with an S.
With an S. Excellent. Multiple growling frogs.
There's lots of us.
.com, but not with
an
AU.
Like many more.
All right, excellent. Just .com.
If anyone else would like to join in to be a frog who doesn't have those previously mentioned skills, we'd love to have you on board anyway.
Why not frog
excellent.
Up?
Excellent. Well, let's say goodbye to Joey. Thank you
Thanks,
for
Joey.
Calling in.